Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The Commission for Peace and National Harmony. This is to make sure that they are always on the loop for those the factors that instigate friction and tension, and to see how they can nip them in the bud before they create any problem.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio says the free education policy is an integral part of his human capital development agenda.
Rather than expend energy trying to suppress a people, any group that wants to go, I think the government or we can create a process where those that want to go can go and those that want to remain should remain.
A delegation from the Nigerian House of Representatives is holding talks with U.S. lawmakers about the security situation in the West African country.
Like everybody else, receive a fair trial and have every opportunity to defend himself. So there is no need for the president or anybody else to be concerned. It is being targeted or being targeted unfairly. The report is what it is. It says what it says based on tested credible evidence, and Dr. Mkhize must deal with it.
And a major South African opposition party says President Cyril Ramaphosa's statement defending a former health minister facing corruption charges is regrettable. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio says the free education policy for all children forms an integral part of his human capital development agenda to improve the lives of the country's future generation. The move, the Sierra Leonean president says, has lifted a heavy burden off the shoulders of all parents in the West African country, irrespective of their political inclinations or societal status. The president dismissed criticisms that the policy is unsustainable, which skeptics say will lead to a lack of quality education and ill-prepared students for tertiary learning or higher education. The president says anecdotal evidence proves the skeptics and critics wrong about the policy. In a sit-down interview, President Maada Bio talked about good governance, transparency, and the need for accountability. He also says the ongoing fight against corruption has blocked the misappropriation of public funds, which he said is helping to pay for the free education policy.
Mr. President, you've been quite vocal about human capital development. You've been talking about this for a long time in Sierra Leone since you were elected. What are you doing about it, and how are you carrying the people of Sierra Leone along in this human capital development that you have so described?
Well, I stood talking about human capital development even before I was elected. I think it was actually on that basis that the Sierra Leoneans chose me instead of any other person. I have stated to them that in as much as Sierra Leone can boast of many natural minerals like gold, diamond, bauxite, and everything, the most important or the most precious of those for me is the human being. And if we can invest appropriately in the human being, it will be the basis for development. And it was on that basis that I actually used it as the flagship program in my campaign. And quite apart from what other people think about human capital development, I have defined it to mean good health, good education, and food security. I believe that if we can feed the mind with education, feed the tummy through food security, and take care of the infrastructure that houses both the brain and the tummy, the human being is good to go. And what have I done? Identified education, and when I identify education, broadly education, meaning all forms of education for the people of Sierra Leone, we have, I realized that not everybody had access to education because of the level of poverty in our country. So I decided to do the heavy lifting. Government decided to pay for every child from pre-primary school to the end of high school. That is for the boys. And for the girls, those doing STEM courses, science and so on and so forth, can go up to university. Anecdotal evidence is beginning to indicate that even the kids are beginning to perform better at school. Retention is better, and everybody is happy because this is the only way we can distribute wealth of every child should have the opportunity that my own child has to go to school and to be a better person, to be part of the development process of Sierra.
Mr. President, how quality is the education? Talking about quality, how are you funding this project? And then how sustainable will this be?
That is a very good question because it is quite expensive. But I have always said that it is not as expensive as ignorance when the population is not educated. For me, in the 21st century, and with the fourth industrial revolution looming, education is an existential thing. We must have it or perish as a nation. It is expensive, but what have we done? We are determined. We have been able to close up most of the loopholes, you know, for corruption in that country. And that is how we've been able to first get the seed money. And once we got going, we have been able to attract a lot of allies, the Global Partnership for Education, the World Bank. A lot of institutions are supporting. So the combination of what we are putting in and what other great partners who mean development, sustainable development for Africa and Sierra Leone, they are putting their money in.
Mr. President, talk to me about good governance. And would you say that your administration or you for leading the government has implemented measures that you are taking to ensure that you meet the standard of good governance that Sierra Leoneans expect from you?
Talking about good governance definitely reminds me about transparency and accountability and making sure that we free up the political space so that political parties can freely partake in elections and the elections are credible and so on and so forth. We have done quite a lot in that direction in the past 3 years. Today, we have removed the death penalty. It has been hanging in the law books and it's been used by several governments to take away the opposition, to threaten them, to silence them. For me, I have decided that that is a thing of the past. The seditious libel law. This is a law that has been used to threaten journalists, and a lot of them have been locked up. As I speak to you, that is also a thing of the past. And if you check in our business today, there is no journalist in prison for practicing journalism. We have set up a core commission to make sure that we keep the peace, that we have the Commission for Peace and National Harmony. This is to make sure that they are always on the loop for those the factors that instigate friction and tension, and to see how they can nip them in the bud before they create any problem.
That was Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. A delegation from the Nigerian House of Representatives is holding talks with U.S. lawmakers about the security situation in the West African country. The Nigerian lawmakers say discussions with the U.S. counterparts have been productive, but add that there are concerns about deteriorating security in parts of the country. This as Nigeria celebrates its 61st Independence Day, Friday, October 1. The situation in Africa's most populous country requires immediate attention from the international community. This as some Nigerians Nigerians call on the International Criminal Court, or ICC, to investigate what they say appears to be gross human rights violations in parts of the country. Officials of the government reject the accusation. They say the administration has stepped up efforts to address the security challenges facing the country. But House of Representatives member Remamde Shawulu Kwewum, a part of the delegation, tells me that the government's effort to resolve the security challenges do not appear to be working.
We met with some members of some caucuses that are interested in what is happening in Africa and Nigeria to exchange ideas and to understand for ourselves the situation that is taking place back at home.
There have been concerns about growing insecurity in Nigeria. It used to be in mainly in part of the north, but it's in other parts of Nigeria as well, and it keeps escalating. What can you tell me about this, and are you talking about this with some of these U.S. lawmakers you have been meeting?
Yeah, actually, every person, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, and even in Nigeria, is concerned about the increasing spread of insecurity in Nigeria. People are disturbed about the killings that take place almost on a daily basis. Then you have the situation in the south, in the northwest, where yesterday the Senate passed a resolution. The House of Representatives, I understand, concurred today, asking that the bandits that have ravaged several states in the northwest, kidnapped thousands of children, driven out several communities, and it should be declared as terrorists. So everywhere you go, people who are interested in Nigeria want to know what actually is happening, whether we in government have been able to handle the situation to, as we say in Nigeria, to be on top of the situation. But as you know, the reports are worsening, and it's becoming clear that we are at loss on what we need to do as a people.
But government officials have been very vocal about the administration trying to put in every effort to rescue the situation. President Buhari is on record to have said Nigeria appears to be getting somewhere, to quote him. What is your take on this?
In the same way that the president had said that Nigeria's economy is improving, you had government officials also saying that things are better than they were in Nigeria before. You have people saying that the security situation has improved. Well, the security situation has improved to the extent that the naira to dollar has improved, if you understand what I mean. If we had insecurity, if in 2015, when Buhari took over, Boko Haram was said to be in control of 17 local government areas in Borno, today, I want to tell you without any fear of contradiction that several local governments on the plateau, people cannot go back to their homes on plateau states. Southern, several local governments in Kaduna are under the siege by Boko Haram. Governors of Niger and Nasarawa state have severally come to Abuja to complain that terrorists and bandits were closing in and were not very far away from Abuja. Well, we expect the president to say he is doing something. But it is very clear that if that is the best shot that the president has, then you can say without any fear of contradictions that we have a very, very long way to go.
The government has described IPOB, the indigenous people of Biafra, the group, as a terrorist organization. However, the group has petitioned the International Criminal Court through a human rights institution here. What is your take on the call for the International Criminal Court to investigate circumstances of gross human rights violations allegedly being committed in Nigeria at the moment?
I do not believe that any freedom of association without the freedom to dissociate is freedom. Meaning that, as far as I'm concerned, any group that wants to get out of Nigeria should be allowed to get out. What we need to do is to draw up the framework that will permit, that will allow such a process to be carried out without shedding of blood. You will notice that in several parts of the world today, new countries have emerged. And where did those new countries emerge from? Those countries emerged from the breakup of certain countries, and like the Soviet Union, rather than expend energy trying to suppress a people, any group that wants to go, I think the government, or we can create a process where those that want to go can go, and those that want to remain should remain.
Rimamde Shawulu Kwewum is a member of the Nigerian House of Representatives. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Burkina Faso has suspended the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, from conducting aid work in the country, citing critical interviews given to the media, including VOA. Henry Wilkins has more from the Burkinabe capital, Ouagadougou.
On Friday, the Burkinabe government announced it had suspended the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, from carrying out humanitarian operations in the country. In a letter from the Minister for Humanitarian Affairs, Helene Marie Laurence Ilboudo-Marchal, the government cited interviews that NRC representatives carried out with the Voice of America and the French newspaper Le Monde as its reasons for suspending the group's activities. The NRC said in a statement Friday that it is working in dialogue with the government to address any concerns they may have in order to resume respectful and collaborative relations and our humanitarian work. The NRC's earlier interviews included claims that the government has been slow to register internally displaced people, citing a group of about 500 IDPs in the city of Waguya, who they said had been waiting weeks for registration and have not received aid. The NRC also made a plea to the government to allow them to step in and assist with registration. In an exclusive interview with VOA earlier this week, Bakawanya Pene Florence, a spokesman for the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, refuted the claims that the IDPs in Waguya had not received aid. He says, going back to the point of IDP registration, as soon as they arrived at the site in Waguya on the 12th of June, the team was deployed immediately and they did the enumeration process. Florem went on to explain that registration of IDPs is only carried out after they have been officially counted and some initial aid provided, including food and $100 for each family. He said the government has put in place a two-month plan for assistance for the group of IDPs. When there's an influx of IDPs, he says, you can't register them because traumatised people can't answer the questions needed to do so immediately. When the first assistance ends and there has been psychological support, the registration takes place at that time. There are 1.3 million internally displaced people in Burkina Faso, which has been embroiled in a six-year conflict between the state and armed groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and local bandits. The UN has called it the world's fastest-growing humanitarian crisis. The government has come under criticism recently from refugee advocacy groups because of a government ban on journalists visiting official IDP sites in the country. The government says the ban is to protect the dignity of IDPs and the safety of journalists. Daouda Diallo is with the Collective Against Impunity and the Stigmatisation of Communities, a Burkinabe human rights group. In an interview with VOA, he criticised the decision to suspend the NRC. He says that on the humanitarian side, it has to be said this is a very serious decision and shows the disregard for the fate of the civilian populations that benefit from the activities of this NGO. The letter from the humanitarian minister said the country was doing its best to assist IDPs under difficult circumstances. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
In South Africa, the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, says President Cyril Ramaphosa's statement defending a former health minister accused of corruption is regrettable. The country's special investigation unit says its inquiry shows Dr. Zweli Mkhize showed a lack of oversight in awarding a $10 million COVID-19 contract. The report says part of the funds were used to purchase a car for the former minister's son. The former health minister denied the allegations. The president was quoted at a press conference as defending Dr. Mkhize as he urged South Africans to be considerate and not to forget the role the former minister played in the government's effort in addressing the global coronavirus pandemic. But the opposition DA says the president's defense is irrelevant to the allegations against Dr. Mkhize. It says the former minister will have his day in court to defend himself against the allegations of corruption. Glenys Breytenbach, a member of South Africa's parliament from the Democratic Alliance and former prosecutor for the National Prosecuting Authority, tells me that the president should focus his energy on running the affairs of the country rather than on defending Dr. Mkhize.
When the president defends him, he's defending him on the basis that he's innocent until proven guilty. I'm not sure that it's something that the president should be commenting on. Dr. Mkhize is the former health minister. He's already vacated that post. And it would be much better for the president to steer clear of that area and to get on with the job of running the country badly as he does it, rather than, you know, spend time defending Dr. Mkhize. Yeah, Dr. Mkhize will have plenty of time to defend himself.
But Glenys, some people are suggesting that the president's defense is in the right place and that South Africans should be moderate in the criticism and that he's innocent before being proven guilty in the court of law. How do you react to that?
He's definitely innocent until proven guilty. Our constitution guarantees that position, and it's the correct position. We're a country that upholds the rule of law. And so Dr. Mkhize is entitled to be viewed as innocent until he has been convicted in a court of law. Absolutely, I agree with that. The fact of the matter is, however, that there is a report that appears to link him quite significantly to the digital vibe scandal. If the report is correct, then there appears to be a lot of evidence. And if that evidence stands scrutiny in a court of law, well, you know, then that will be a problem for Dr. Mkhize. So the president is correct to say that he is innocent until proven guilty, and I agree with that position. But I do think that the president should have better things to do than be defending Dr. Mkhize.
Well, the president is quoted as saying, much as we want to be gung-ho and send people to the gallows and all that, we also need to recognize some of the things they have done. Dr. Mkhize has served the nation well, he said at a press briefing on Wednesday. What is your take on that?
No, that's irrelevant. You know, that's comparing apples with pears. It doesn't matter whether Dr. Mkhize has served the nation well. It doesn't matter if he's a wonderful man. The fact of the matter is there are credible allegations of corruption against him. He's entitled to be viewed as innocent until proven guilty, but that matter must take its course, and it's not now for the president to say that we should bear in mind that he has served the country well. He must face a trial if that's necessary, and he will either be convicted or exonerated. And whether or not he has served the country well will be taken into account at that stage. It's not relevant now, and the president would do well to stay away from that.
So, Glenys, what do you make of those who are of the opinion that Dr. Mkhize is being targeted unfairly?
Dr. Mkhize has not been found guilty of anything, and so he will have plenty of opportunity to state his case. The report has examined a huge amount of documentation and evidence. The report finds significant reason to find a link between Dr. Mkhize and the digital vibes corruption scandal, and also family members of his. And so there's nothing unfair about him being targeted, and he's not being targeted. He's been linked by evidence, credible evidence that's been examined by professional people who do that for a living, lawyers, accountants, forensic investigators, forensic analysts. So it's not a report that's written by a school child. It's a credible report based on credible evidence. And Dr. Mkhize will have to deal with those allegations.
There's a school of thought that perhaps the president's defense could influence any possible legal process that Dr. Mkhize might go through. Others are saying that the president is free to express his opinion as guaranteed by the Constitution, and that the president's statement will not have any impact on the legal process. What is your take?
Of course, the president's statements will not have an impact on the legal process. The legal process will run its course. It's unwise for the president to make those types of statements. The president is the president of the whole country and of everybody in it. And he should spend his time running our country. Our country is in a lot of trouble, and it would do well for him to spend his time concentrating on running the country and doing a better job than he's doing now. And leave Dr. Mkhize to fight his own battle. And Dr. Mkhize will, like everybody else, receive a fair trial and have every opportunity to defend himself. So there is no need for the president or anybody else to be concerned is being targeted or being targeted unfairly. The report is what it is. It says what it says, based on tested, credible evidence, and Dr. Mkhize must deal with.
Glenys Breytenbach is a member of South Africa's Parliament from the Democratic Alliance and a former prosecutor for the National Prosecuting Authority. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the president of the African Development Bank says Africa is ready for increased U.S. investments. Dr. Akinwumi Adesina says before the global coronavirus pandemic, Africa still had the 6th fastest growing economies in the world, adding that the fundamentals remain valid today. His remarks come as he held a series of meetings with senior U.S. government officials and business leaders here in Washington. Dr. Adesina also underscored his expectations of the upcoming Africa Investment Forum Market Days. It is one of the African Development Bank's annual flagship events, which has drawn significant investor interest from around the world in the last 3 years. The third edition runs from December 1 to the 3rd. Dr. Adesina has also been vocal around the issue of vaccine inequity and why there's need to address shortage on the African continent. For more about his meetings here in Washington, D.C., I reached Dr. Akinwumi Adesina via Skype.
Yeah, I think first and foremost is to remember that, you know, even before the pandemic, Africa has 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world. You look even with the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, that is going to be a free trade area with 1.3 billion people and a collective GDP of $3.3 trillion that you have. And so when you look at what that means, you know, you have the consumer and business expenditures in that continent, in the continent, going to rise to $6.7 trillion by 2030. So that tells you that the fundamentals of Africa are as strong as they were. And so basically my mission into the U.S. is basically to encourage the U.S. private sector to invest massively in Africa, in particular infrastructure and energy, in particular in terms of renewable energy and digital infrastructure. So basically, our role as African Development Bank is to tell the investment story of Africa. Second is to actually give the investors the confidence that they can invest because we can help to source the deals. We can design bankable projects. We can do risk projects. And we can ensure that governments actually do the right thing in terms of the business investment and regulatory environment. So basically, I want to have a real recalibration of significant institutional investors investing in Africa. And that's why I'm here. And that's all my meetings have been really directed at this time.
Well, talking about the pandemic, Dr. Adesina, you have been very vocal around the issue of vaccine inequity, alongside fellow multilateral financial institution leaders like the IMF's Kristalina Georgieva. Why this stance?
The coronavirus does not need visas. It doesn't need permission of anybody to move around the world. So it's an existential risk for everybody. And that's why we have to really, I've been quite vocal about access to vaccines. Take a look at it today in Africa. Only 24 million Africans have been vaccinated. And so you have a continent that is now being treated fairly in terms of access, in terms of the equity with regard to vaccinations. And that's because you have a situation wherein the developed countries bought up all the vaccines and advanced purchase agreements, locked it all up. And so the key really is making sure that Africa doesn't go through this again. So we want to make sure that we're dealing with this in 3 ways. One is to encourage global manufacturing companies of vaccines to relocate to Africa. And I think we're making some good headways there. But at the end of the day, you know, vaccines aren't things you just pick off the shelf and you start running and selling, right? You need to build your own indigenous R&D capacity to do that. And at the African Development Bank, we are working right now to support Africa in this. We need to have an African healthcare defense system. Look at this as a defense system that requires greater investment in pharmaceuticals, greater investment in vaccine manufacturing upon the in the continent, but also joining that with greater investment in quality healthcare infrastructure, primary healthcare, secondary, tertiary healthcare infrastructure, and diagnostic facilities. So those three things have to work in tandem to secure the health of Africa. Quite honestly, I don't think that Africa should outsource its health security to the benevolence of others.
One of the African Development Bank's annual flagship events, which has drawn significant investor interest from around the world in the last 3 years, is the bank's Forum Market Days. Its third edition runs from December 1 to 3 this year. Now, tell me a little bit more about it and your expectations for this year, especially.
Well, the Africa Investment Forum is Africa's, has become Africa's premier investment marketplace. And what makes it very unique is that we actually, you know, there are no speeches in these meetings. You know, it's all transactions, deals and deals and deals. What investors will tell you is, why will I want to invest in Africa? Because I actually don't know whether they are bankable projects. Well, we've shown that they are really very bankable projects. In 2018, when we had the Africa Investment Forum first premier edition, we were able to mobilize $38.7 billion of investment interest in Africa on bankable projects in less than 72 hours. Just think of that. And we did it again in 2019, and were able to secure investment interest of $40.1 billion. And so that means that the investment opportunities are actually there. Of course, things got really affected by the COVID-19 situation. However, going back now to the Investment Africa Investment Forum Market Days for 2021, the event will hold 1 to 3rd of December in Abidjan under a hybrid model. We will have some people in Abidjan that will link to others globally. We will run the investment boardroom sessions where we bring in the investors, the project developers, the insurance companies, the legal facilities, and the banks that can help to co-finance or syndicate or de-risk projects that are all going to be there with heads of state. Everybody is eager to have investment rebound now in Africa.
Dr. Akinwumi Adesina is the president of the African Development Bank. He spoke with me from here in Washington. The United Nations is calling on the Ethiopian government to rescind its decision to expel top UN officials from the country, warning the action puts life-saving humanitarian operations at risk. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
On Thursday, the Ethiopian government told seven senior officials, including the heads of the UN Children's Fund and OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, that they had 72 hours to leave the country. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says she deplores the government's decision to declare the UN officials as persona non grata, or as unacceptable persons. She rejects allegations that one of her staff and four human rights monitors were meddling in the internal affairs of Ethiopia. Her spokesman, Rupert Colville, says no warning of the impending expulsions was received.
Basically, this was a bombshell that dropped suddenly yesterday afternoon, and I think we were all caught completely by surprise. Also by the scale of it, seven staff across three agencies is extremely rare, if not unprecedented.
OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the senior UN officials are responsible for overseeing the humanitarian operations of many agencies, including non-governmental organizations. He warns their expulsion will have serious repercussions for millions of destitute, homeless people in northern Ethiopia's conflict-ridden Tigray region.
It remains very dire, and there's a spillover of the conflict into neighboring Amhara and Afar regions, which rapidly means that the humanitarian needs are increasing and also the number of internally displaced people is increasing. The food insecurity continues to increase with at least 5.2 million people targeted for emergency food assistance in Tigray.
However, trucks containing emergency food and other humanitarian supplies are stuck in Afar. They are not moving on to Tigray because of insecurity and other restrictions. Lierke says only 11% of designated humanitarian trucks have entered Tigray since July. UN agencies are appealing to Ethiopian authorities to reconsider Thursday's decision and allow the UN officials to remain in the country to continue their human rights and humanitarian work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, the Ethiopian government is coming under criticism following its decision to expel 7 UN officials after accusing them of meddling in the country's affairs. The move came after a senior UN official warned that hundreds of thousands of people in the Tigray region may be forced into famine because of the administration's block on aid to the affected areas. Refugees International says the expulsion of the UN staff will create a vacuum, which it argues will significantly affect efforts by the international community to help ease what it says is the growing humanitarian crisis. The global advocacy organization is also calling on members of the UN Security Council and the African Union to pressure the Ethiopian government to stop the aid blockade. Hardin Lang, vice president at Refugees International, tells me that expelling the UN officials during a time of crisis will only make things worse.
I mean, the decision by the Ethiopian government, it's deeply, deeply concerning, right? They've taken aim at the leadership of UNICEF, which provides assistance to children, but does much more than that inside of the Ethiopia and the Tigray context. And then also, most of the staff that they've PNG'd came from OCHA, which is the Humanitarian Emergency Coordinator arm of the UN system. And so what you're doing is going into the humanitarian coordination structure and decapitating it. And that move is deeply troubling, not only because it feels much like an extension of the sort of the kind of policy of closure with respect to humanitarian space and access that many humanitarian agencies have been confronting in the Tigray crisis and the famine that's now beginning to play out. But in addition, across sort of, you know, other parts of the country as well, you know, where there are humanitarian challenges, including in neighboring regions to Tigray, where the conflict has spread in recent months. And so I think it's going to have an impact not just in Tigray, but across a broader scope of areas.
There were reports that these individuals or these UN staff were interfering in the internal dynamics of Ethiopia. What do you make of this report?
To be honest, that sounds very much like some of the previous rhetoric that the Ethiopian government has used, in essence, to sort of paint humanitarians in a political light, right? So it's really at the heart of any humanitarian mission to be principled, neutral, impartial, and independent. And what you're seeing here is sort of this effort that's a continuation of ongoing sort of practice to label the humanitarians as somehow partial to one side of the conflict. These are senior leaders inside of the UN system who have deep experience in a number of crises across the world. The idea that somehow they would be getting directly involved in the internal politics of a conflict in Ethiopia strikes me as a bit of a stretch.
There have been reports of warnings of famine. Will this vacuum that has been created affect the response of the international community or perhaps the UN in providing assistance to those who need it?
The United Nations has estimated months ago that at least 400,000 people were in famine-like conditions. USAID Administrator Samantha Power said that number was closer to 900,000 in recent months. Our sense is the number is probably higher than that. So our sense is that famine is already very much underway in Tigray, even if we don't have all the data to articulate the nature of the case at this stage. A. B, Ethiopia has already kicked out two large, significant humanitarian relief agencies. Doctors Without Borders and the Norwegian Refugee Committee have been asked to suspend their operations in and around Tigray. Both agencies did significant work in terms of lessening the impact of the crisis. Now you're having an effort made to remove the leadership of the UN system that oversees those efforts. Our sense is all of these steps are simply a continuation of, in essence, of the blockade policy that the government has in place and are going to significantly contribute to the continuation of the crisis. This is a man-made crisis. It requires steps by the government, but indeed all parties to the conflict, to stop fighting and to open up access to people in need. And this is a step very much in the wrong direction.
So what do you think the African Union can do? The United States, other members of the Security Council can do to ease the anticipated worsening of the problem that we see in Ethiopia at the moment, or the blockade, perhaps, if you want.
This is, I think the members of the Security Council and members of the African Union need to be speaking with one voice, right? In the sense that calling upon the parties to declare a ceasefire, to prioritize the, you know, the very deep and broad nature of the humanitarian emergency in Tigray, to stop fighting and to open up access to allow humanitarians to get in. That needs to be the number one top priority. And right now, we need to see pressure coming from and leadership coming from those in the region, the African Union, first and foremost, but also from the Security Council, really making it clear that what is about to happen could very well be of sort of, you know, a regional, like, catastrophic level of suffering. And we need all member states and friends and partners of Ethiopia to focus their attention on getting the parties of the conflict to stop fighting, at least temporarily, and to open up access. Obviously, over the longer term, we'd want to see some sort of political process to resolve these situations. But the absolute priority right now is staving off the worst that famine has to offer.
Harding Lang is the vice president at Refugees International. He spoke with me from here in Washington. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Propose faster, kuchelewa cause nearly fall in love. Sio kutamani, najivunia lo nimekuweka ndani. Japo na leta beef kwa mashaka wa mtani. Vitisho vingi vya mapenzi flying, sijali. Namshukuru Mola aliye juu, kwangu wewe zaidi ya dreams come true. Kila tunapotembea pamoja kama pair, majina yetu mwisho wote leo ni jana kwa tumeshine. Uko fine, napendo na good design. My Valentine's and I'm so glad you are. Baby, you're mine. Baby, you're mine.
Avenue. Yeah, girl. We go dance every day, anytime, anywhere. Dancing life, oh, oh. We go dance, oh, oh. Yeah, and we go.
J'ai permis du soir pour piloter. Elle sait comment faire pour élever le Madame a le niveau. Elle me dit mon chéri, fais-moi tout ça là là. Je veux des bisous là là là. Ne reste pas là là là. Enlève le cadenas. Chéri, fais-moi tout ça là là. Je veux des bisous là là là. Ne reste pas là là là. Enlève le cadenas. Elle veut que je chante pour elle chaque jour, mon bébé. Elle dit que ma voix lui donne de l'amour, mon bébé. Elle veut que je chante pour elle chaque jour, mon bébé. Fais comme tu sais faire, fais-moi ton adieu, mon bébé. Naïe, naïe, yo. Naïe, naïe, yo. Naïe, mais la maman, voyons qu'à bien. Naïe, mais la bébé, voilà la bien. Je vais chanter pour te soigner. Je vais chanter pour te soigner. Laisse-moi te prouver.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, it is the patience of the chameleon that allows it to catch more flies. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.